This is Chapter Day. I'm Jim Fleming. I'm reading from Little Hawk and the Lone Wolf, a memoir by Raymond Cacatosh, published by the Wisconsin State Historical Society Press. He was born in 1924 on the Menominee Indian Reservation near Neopit, Wisconsin. He grew up surrounded by nature. After some time at the Indian boarding school near Kashina, he has gone back to his family. Chapter 5. July 25th, 1934 was my 10th birthday, and I was given a small teddy bear. I treasured that little bear for years, but I lost it when I finally left home. Now I have another one enclosed in a glass container. I look at it from time to time and reminisce about my 10th birthday and my first teddy bear. Not long after my birthday, my sister Cecilia was to be married to Melvin. As preparations for the big event began, Cecilia and Melvin asked me if I wanted to participate in the wedding. "Why not?" I replied. Melvin smiled. We headed out for Shawano to buy wedding presents and the marriage certificate. On the way back home, Mel said to me, "You just had your 10th birthday. Now you should be learning how to drive." With a big smile, I replied, "Okay with me." We pulled the seat forward and put his coat over it so I could see over the hood and reach the pedals. His instructions were explicit. "Steering wheel, turn it left, you go left. Turn it right, you go right. Foot pedals. The one on the left is the clutch, the one on the right is the brake. Small pedal is the gas pedal. Shift lever, three speeds forward and one reverse. H pattern." He showed me the positions. Here we go. I pushed in the clutch pedal, shifted to the lowest gear, and released the clutch. Slowly. After we started moving, I shifted to the number two position and then to the number three position. "Keep driving in the right lane and never drive on the left side. You're doing fine," Melvin told me. When he told me to stop, I stopped. After repeating his instructions, he warned, "Any time I catch you driving over the standard line, you're going to get a kick in the pants." And then more seriously, he added, "Don't tell your mother." When you're young, the summer passes too quickly. Although I did not have to go back to the boys' school at Kashina, the thought of going back to school still saddened me because I would have to wear shoes. New shoes are hard to break in, especially when you've been going barefoot all summer. The soles of your feet become hard and calloused, making it even more difficult to keep your shoes on. September began to cool Neopit with a hint of frost to start the leaves fading and taking on different colors. Dark red for maple, yellow for poplar, lighter red for oak. Elm, a yellow-orange. Mother Earth mixed all these colors together, and I put on a spectacular show. Walking through the trees, I could smell the aroma of the leaves. Made me want to walk farther. I could walk a mile among those colors and not get tired. The air was so invigorating. When the geese began to fly south, we knew it was time again to prepare for the long winter months. The white men have Thanksgiving, but not the Indians. How can we be thankful for all the treaties they broke? Better we partake in the harvest feast, when we give thanks to the Great Spirit for being so kind to us all summer and for giving us plenty of food for the winter. Remember that not all Menominee families think and act like my family did. Some participate in celebrating Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays. Catholics observe a time they call All Souls Day, and our family had a version of that, except my mother did things differently. She prepared a huge meal, and then, just as I was about to sit down and satisfy my hunger, she told us to vacate the room and closed all the doors. We had to wait a few minutes before re-entering the room. This was the time when the spirits of our ancestors would be invited to partake in the meal, a sign of our appreciation. When I grew older, I noticed that my family was not the only one that did this. Other Menominee families had a similar practice and gave similar offerings. There is no such thing as an official Indian prayer. This was something my mother taught me. She said, "Talk to the Great Spirit as if he were standing right next to you. Ask for a special favor. Don't pray for one." Outside our house facing north, my mother would make the following offering. A talk with the north wind, the Cacatosh way. Autumn is the time to offer smoke from the peace pipe to the north wind, who brings us the icy winds and covers the earth with a blanket of white. Long before the water turns to ice, we ask the mighty north wind to be kind to us during the winter months. Also, we ask the north wind not to stay any longer than necessary to kill all the germs that cover the earth, Don't breathe too long on the animals, or they will feel your wrath, for you, O North Wind, are the most powerful of all winds. We will talk to you again when you make the waters solid like a rock. When you speak to us with your strong voice, make it brief, because we know how powerful you are. We are weak and only here for a little while, but you go on forever. Be kind to us, O Winter Wind, and we will be grateful. Next year, we hope to welcome you back, if the Great Spirit permits us. The humble words of my mother's offering, words spoken to the North Wind, will be with me for a long time. These words may differ slightly from what my mother said, but it is the spirit of the talk with the North Wind that I most remember. Many ethnic groups practice some sort of rituals considered witchcraft. Some Menominee people practice witchcraft. It is still being used at this time, but all my witchcraft experiences were during my youth. I lived two blocks from the cemetery in Neopit, in an area referred to as the Crow's Nest. My home was located on a witch's trail, and I frequently observed witches on their way to do their errands. The term witch refers to a female, and a male is called a wizard, but because of the lack of understanding in the white man's language, the word witch is often used for both. When I saw a witch on its mission, it was usually in the form of an animal or a bird or had a ball of fire in its mouth. The ball of fire itself was not harmful, but it is believed that when one encounters a witch, 4 days later, someone will die. Taking on the form of an animal is an evil practice done by self-hypnosis. Some people refer to this as shape-shifting. I once watched a man perform this ritual, lying flat on the floor with only a blanket for a cushion. He didn't seem to be breathing. I thought he was dead. He remained in that position until the next morning. When he awakened, he was bruised and had a visible wound on his right arm, possibly caused by an encounter with a person or animal during his ill-fated mission. My mother scolded me for observing his actions. Some Menominee believe that the soul of a victim of witchcraft must be protected for 4 days after death. Years ago, a person's body was kept in the home for 4 days, and someone had to guard the body so that the soul would not be disturbed on its journey to the hereafter. I'm going to tell you a true story about my Uncle Arthur from Chicago. It happened one night when I was a boy and he was vacationing with us. My Uncle Arthur was not an Indian. Late one evening, when we were all in bed, our room unexpectedly became illuminated to the point that we could see each other clearly. My brother informed me that the light was actually a witch. Uncle Arthur scoffed at this. "There's no such thing as a witch." The next morning he packed up everything and returned to Chicago with his family. Once back at home, he went into the bathroom of their apartment and he never emerged. He was never heard from again. Soon the cold first month of 1935 was upon us. The temperature seemed to continually linger below zero, and in this frigid weather I had to walk to school every day. The snow crunched with every step and my nose turned red. The air was hard to breathe. One evening I had to make an appearance for a school play that didn't start until after dark. A light snow had fallen earlier that day. As I headed back home and the lights faded behind me, I felt uneasy, like I was being stalked. I was startled when I heard a noise alongside of me. It was so dark I couldn't see my hand in front of my nose. I didn't know what it was that walked beside me. If we were ever caught in the presence of a wild or dangerous animal, we were told to make a lot of noise. I began to holler and shout, hoping somebody nearby would hear me. It was then that I heard Maggie Lyon's dog bark. I was less afraid of that mean bulldog than of whatever else was out there, and I ran all the way to Maggie's driveway and began to shout for Maggie. She came out of the house, and I told her what had frightened me. She promised to stay by the roadside until I got almost home. She'll never know how much I appreciated that. When I told my story to my brothers, they laughed and called me a weakling for being afraid of the dark. Later, I found some large footprints in the snow. The prints seemed to be like a dog's, but the dog had to be much heavier than your average dog because the prints sank deep into the snow. After that night, I dropped out of the school play, and I decided to carry a knife and a pointed stick with a sharp end. You could call it a lance. Another snowfall came, and the next morning I was glad to see the blanket of white the North Wind had sent us. With the thick snow, I could build a snow house or a fort to help ward off an imaginary enemy. As I put on my snowshoes, I thought of using the fresh snow to track rabbits, squirrels, and porcupines. And then I thought, wolves, too. I better have my lance ready. My mother told me that wolves travel in packs because they cannot survive alone. But I wondered if the creature who had come upon me the other night was a lone wolf. That must have been what he was, just a lone wolf. He might have been ostracized from the pack, just like I was when my family sent me off to the Kashina Boys' School. Hey, we had something in common. I learned that most lone wolves were males, so he had to be a male. And I knew he had followed me that night. Why didn't he attack? He had an easy prey. Later, I decided the lone wolf must have been trying to be friendly. I'd always wanted a dog. Now I realized that the Great Spirit must have sent this animal to me. Early one morning, as I was getting ready to go to school, my mother told me that the snow was too deep and the plows hadn't had a chance to clear the road, so I had to stay home. Gazing at the pines with their branches heavily laden with snow, I saw the snow suddenly fall from them, and the branches quickly swing back up. Then I saw him. He leapt high to get over the heavy snow and looked toward our home. Both his ears were pointing straight up. One turned sideways, then forward. Then the other did the same. This indicated to me that his defense mechanisms were functioning. His nose sniffed at the air and his tail wrapped around his legs. His coat was almost as white as the snow. What a magnificent sight! I will always remember him like that. By the time I called my mother to the window, he was gone. She laughed and said, "You got wolves on your mind." Then I thought about the snow. I could find his tracks and prove I was not seeing things. But the tracks would just as easily prove he was a large dog. I knew he was a wolf, but no one would believe me. So there was only one thing to do. Kill him before he killed me. My cousin had a .22 caliber rifle that he allowed me to borrow for the deplorable act I was about to commit. He said, "I hope you get him." Now all I had to do was wait. It didn't take long. One bright sunny morning the lone wolf returned. When I saw him, about 200 yards from the house, I rushed to get the rifle and loaded it with a .22 long-range bullet. Slowly I opened the window and took careful aim at him as he sat peacefully in the snow. Then I squeezed the trigger. Bang! I felt the recoil from the rifle and saw the disturbance of the snow to the left of him. I'd missed, because of the wind or possibly because of divine intervention. I preferred to think it was the latter. I thought I would never get another shot at him. Wolves know when they're being hunted. Well, at least I'd scared him off. My eldest brother woke up when he heard the shot and came rushing downstairs. "What's all the shooting about?" When I told him that I'd tried to shoot a wolf, he screamed at me, "That wolf may be one of our relatives who died and came back as a wolf." Well, I hadn't considered that I could have killed my own father. The wolf was young and must have been born about the same time my father died. As I sat by the window, with my head hanging down, I felt a hand on my shoulder and looked up to see my mother smiling. "You missed for some good reason. You'll find out later." For the next few days, I couldn't get over the sinful act I'd almost committed. It haunted me, and I wished to make amends. The temperature was still below zero, and I didn't have to go to school. Nothing to do but keep the home fires burning. One day, I took off toward the island on the Wolf River to get firewood. As I crossed the highway, I couldn't help thinking about the lone wolf. I was sure he'd never return. On the way back, I glanced toward the edge of the woods by our home. I thought I saw some movement. Then I saw the wolf jump over a pile of snow. His breath came out in puffs of steam as he ran. He stopped and looked back at me. I froze. Now it was his turn to kill. When you're facing death, there's only one thing to do. Ask the Creator for forgiveness. Just like the Mother Superior said, ask the man upstairs for help and everything will be all right. The lone wolf started to walk slowly toward me. He had his head down, and I knew he was about to attack. I was carrying a small tree, and I slowly put it down to grab my axe. Then I looked up at Father Sky and thought, "Oh, Great Spirit, help me befriend this animal I tried to kill. I will never try to harm him again." At that instant, the wolf stopped walking and sat down. He let me go. Slowly, I picked up the tree and started to walk back to the house, keeping an eye on him for any sudden movement. The wolf just sat there, never moving until I got into the house. I ran to tell my mother, "He's back!" I pointed to show her where he was, but by then he was gone. A little later, my mother said a strange thing. "He'll be back. Just don't try to kill him." She said another strange thing. "Be nice to him." How can I be nice to a wild animal? Well, then it occurred to me. Food. That's it. He must be hungry. I would put out some food for him, and maybe this would make up for my trying to shoot him. With below-zero temperatures, it must be difficult to catch something to eat. All the small animals were staying holed up to keep warm. So I put some food around the places I'd last seen the wolf, but the wind blew snow over it. Then I got a brilliant idea. I would put some meat on a stick. That way the snow would not cover it. Hey, this little Indian was getting some smarts. Early one morning I checked the places I'd baited with food. The wolf had taken all the pieces I'd put out for him. Now all I had to do was put out more food. Each day I placed the meat closer to the house. One day I put it in a dish by the door. He didn't mind, and now he had his own dish. All those years I'd yearned for a German shepherd, and now I had something better, an animal that could stay out all winter and not freeze to death. And I didn't even have to build him a doghouse. One day I put some meat in his dish and waited for him to approach the house. It took a little while, but soon he came running. He stopped when I opened the door. It was the second time I'd made eye contact with him. I feared he might take this as a challenge, but I guess he was too hungry. The next day I threw some meat at him, and he ran away. Maybe he thought I was angry at him. Each morning, about the same time, I put some food in his dish. One morning he was waiting, and as I approached him, he wagged his tail. Hey, this guy's getting friendly, I thought. Now all I had to do was talk to him or whistle. Every time I put out food, I would whistle or bang on a pan, and he'd come running. Any sudden move, and he'd run away. I'd slowly walk over close to him and fill his dish, then slowly walk away. Next, a bigger test. After giving him his food one day, I took my axe and headed for his domain. Sure enough, he started tailing me and waited while I chopped down a tree. He followed me home and then returned to the woods. I was still afraid to walk to school, so I always took my lance and my jackknife with me. Now, on the way to school, Catherine and I would see the wolf running along the highway. When we got to the playground, he disappeared back into the woods. One day, while I was at school, I suddenly remembered that I'd forgotten to put out food for the wolf. Oh, well, he won't starve, I thought. I'll put some out later. When I entered the house, my mother was shaken up. She told me I was outside, and that wolf jumped on my arm. Still shaking, she added, I thought he was going to attack, and I screamed. I told her I'd forgotten to put out some food for him, and he was just being friendly. Huh! Now you tell me, she grumbled. The lone wolf didn't return for 2 days, and I thought I'd lost him. He kept out of sight, and I thought it was a waste of time to go look for him because he was too frightened to return. Nevertheless, I kept putting food in his dish, and one day he returned and took all of it. Now all I had to do was regain his confidence. Didn't take long. After I called him for his daily meal and he had his fill, I decided to walk along the river banks to gather firewood. He followed and ran ahead of me, then turned and ran close by my side. As he ran close to me again, I brushed his back. He kept doing this and wagged his tail. Then he slowed down so I could brush his back. I even patted his head. His bushy tail just kept wagging. Once again, he trusted me, and I would not let him down, ever again. He was a timber wolf, just like the one my father encountered on his way home from the logging camps. He must have been about 1.5 years old. He seemed to be fully grown and weighed about 75 pounds. As he grew older, he put on more weight and grew taller. Everyone said to me, "You cannot tame a wolf." but we showed them. I also had to get him to accept the other members of my family. That took a little more time, and we had a lot of that. I had a wolf, and the wolf had me. It was hard to believe this magnificent animal was my friend. He embodied the Indian spirit of freedom. He roamed the territory and also displayed aloofness. We had something else in common. We were both lone wolves. The only friends I had were my little sister and my wolf. Now I had to think of a name for him. Corn to the Indian is like bread to the white man, the staff of life. When the seed of corn is planted and combines with the earth, it starts to grow. This wolf was a seed of friendship, so I called him Colonel. My brothers approved of the name because they thought I had called him Colonel, like in the army. I never told them that I had the seed in mind when I named him. At first, when I called his name, he just looked at me. So whenever I put food in his dish, I would say his name. Then, every time I wanted his attention, I'd holler his name. That didn't take too long for him to respond. One day, I put a loose rope around Colonel's neck, and it almost cost me our friendship. Colonel tried to bite it off and tried to bite me also. I quickly slipped it off and petted him for a long time after. He'd lived his whole life without a collar. He had to be free, just like me. Putting a collar around that wolf's neck was a dumb thing to do. When life is progressing well, beware of the unexpected, my mother always reminded me. One day when we started back home from school, some boys were waiting for us along the way. They turned their dogs loose, and the dogs attacked Colonel. I thought they were going to tear him apart. With my heavy winter clothing and gloves on, I grabbed one of the dogs by the tail and pulled it off Colonel. Didn't take long for Colonel to send the other dog squealing down the road, but the one I had by the tail turned on me and bit my coat. The dog had me by the arm and would not let go. The boys were laughing at us as the dog dragged me along. Colonel chased the dog that ran off, but soon he came running back to see the other dog biting my arm. Colonel bit that dog on the neck and started dragging it backwards with my arm still in the dog's mouth. Finally, I managed to break loose. Colonel and the dog stood on their hind legs looking almost like boxers, trying to get an opening for a knockout punch. Then Colonel got the dog by the throat and ripped part of it out. When the blood started to pour out of the dog, it could no longer stand, and soon it fell over and died. I turned to those other boys and said, "I hope you had a good laugh. Your wolf killed my dog. Why didn't you just call him off me? Ah, he was just playing. You're lying. Look at my arm." I showed him where his dog bit into me. "I nipped you. Look at my arm. It's bleeding. That's a nip." "We should never have done this," said the other boy. "Yeah," I huffed. "Tell that to the dead dog over there." This was the first time Colonel displayed ferocity toward another dog. He usually backed away, but it wasn't his fault. He did what was best for both of us. Now we had to go home and lick our wounds. My arm was bleeding, yet I felt sorry for that dead dog. Colonel looked like he was bleeding, so I hurried home to check his wounds. When I wiped his coat, I found that most of the blood was from the other dog. I tried to examine him further, but he just shook his coat, letting me know he was all right. When we got home, my arm was still bleeding, and my mother said, "We better get you to a doctor. I suppose the police will be making a visit soon." She was right again. When we were getting ready to head for town, there was a knock at the door, and my mother answered, "Come in." And in came the town policeman. "I came to shoot your wolf," he said. With a stern look, my mother told him, "You'll have to shoot my son also." "Why?" asked the policeman. "He was being mauled by one of those boys' dogs, and his wolf killed it. Is that a good enough reason to kill it?" "Well, I guess not." Then he asked if I would tell him about it. I told him everything. When I finished, the policeman asked why the two boys didn't stop their dogs. I told him that the boys thought it was funny. "Well, I don't think it's funny. And that is not what they told me," replied the policeman. I hugged Colonel close and said, "You're not going to shoot him?" "No, but don't take him into town, or someone else might." The policeman seemed to be convinced by my story, and he gave me a ride to the doctor's office. He told me once I got patched up I should come to the station. "What for?" "I want those two boys straightened out." After taking care of my wounds, a kindly doctor told me to come back in 2 days. We went to see the man who made the complaint about the dead dog. He let us in and asked why we were there. The policeman answered, "To explain why your dog got killed." He told me to tell the man what had happened. The man had a mean look on his face, but I looked at him and repeated what I'd told the policeman. "Your dog had me on the ground with my arm in its mouth, and it was dragging me around, and your son did nothing to stop it. He just stood there laughing. That's when my wolf attacked." The man turned to his son. "Is that true?" His son didn't answer. "Answer me, Mike." The kid started to cry. The policeman told Mike he owed me an apology. His father refuted, "He doesn't know anyone anything." When the policeman asked if I wanted to file a complaint, I shook my head no. As we were about to leave, I said to Mike, "When my arm heals, I want to have a little talk with you." "Well, then I'll have a talk with you," Mike's dad snapped. The policeman gave a hard look at the man and replied, "Then I will have a talk with you, understand?" The man didn't answer. On the way home, the policeman told me that he never did like that guy. Now I've lost all respect for him. When my mother found out who the man was, she asked what was going to be done about my arm. The policeman told her that I had refused to make a complaint. But it wasn't too late to make one. "That guy's a sneaky, lying, low-down skunk," my mother spat. They both laughed. I didn't smile. My arm was still hurting. Colonel's wounds healed quickly, and he never showed signs of discomfort. All he did was roll in the snow. At night, he returned to the woods to sleep. Never had the need to make him a doghouse. He made his own under a big fallen tree. One day I accidentally found it. He dug under the tree and bedded the ground with leaves. Looked pretty comfortable to me. This was his den. Every morning, when I was about to depart for school, I told Colonel to stay home. After the dog attack, it was difficult to make him stay. He seemed to sense that I needed protection. But it was really the other way around. He needed to be protected from people. Little Hawk and the Lone Wolf, a memoir by Raymond C. Cacatosh, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. I'm Jim Fleming. I hope you're enjoying the book and that you'll be here again for Chapter Day.